also a co-founder of the Indigenous Environmental Knowledge Institute at Carleton University. They were not already one of my biggest role models as an Indigenous scholar. After this interview, I definitely will put them up there in my top five most influential Indigenous thinkers. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Todd on Unseen Airwaves. Hi, Dr. Todd. Would you mind introducing yourself with your name, pronouns, and anything else that kind of feels right for you in this moment?
Yeah, hi, I'm Zoe. I'm an incoming associate professor of Indigenous Studies at Simon Fraser University. I'm Red River Métis from a very big family of Todds. A lot of us are here on the coast and very grateful to get to live here in unceded Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, and Musqueam lands and elsewhere in the province. I grew up in Edmonton. I'm really passionate about fish, and I've been called the fish philosopher, or Dr. FPT for short. And I'm really excited to talk with you today.
Amazing. Yes, thank you so much for joining me. For any listeners, to context how I know about Dr. Zoe Todd is in my First Nation Endangered Language course this semester, where we focus on biocultural diversity, we read your paper on fish pluralities with research that you conducted in Palatuk in the Northwest Territories. So Palatuk in the Northwest Territories. And I'm really curious, what inspired you to go northward?
That's a great question. So when I was doing my master's at the University of Alberta, I was really interested in relationships between environment and Indigenous knowledge and governance. And I was working with a professor at the time named Brenda Parley. And she had a lot of research relationships in the region. But it actually, before that, two of my uncles have lived and worked in the Inuvialuit settlement region and also in the Gwich'in settlement area, in Inuvik and Yellowknife. And my older sister was actually born in Yellowknife. So my family has, as Métis often find ourselves in other Indigenous people's homelands, we're traveling through, taking work, and so there was already kind of a family connection through work to the region. But then when my supervisor had research relationships in that area as well and funding, that kind of led me to sort of go, with her on some of her visits. And in the end, I was able to meet with people in Palatuk way back in 2007 and ask if they were interested potentially in having a master's student join them and do some work looking at community experiences of food sovereignty, food security, and the community was incredibly supportive. And someone named Lawrence Rubin was an incredibly important person in kind of welcoming me in as a very young and very junior and green student. And so that initial work was on questions that the community was raising about the cost of food in the community. So I did my master's on that. And then through the course of that, people very kindly took me out on the land and took me fishing. And that sort of led to questions about, a few years down the line when I was starting a PhD, would people be interested in maybe potentially sort of creating some work on fishing, and several women in the community were really, really encouraging and said, it would be really cool if maybe you looked at women in fishing, because not a lot of research has sort of at that time, this is now over a decade ago, not a lot of non-Indigenous Northern researchers were talking to women about their fishing lives, but women in all communities play a really important part in fishing and hunting and other on the land activities. And so that kind of led to my PhD work, which was at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. And that was a whole other journey. But that also through time that I spent on the land with friends and teachers, my cat is playing with a sticker here. But spending time on the land with my friends Andy and Millie Thrasher and their family was really instructive. And that was kind of how I really was immersed in the work that the community is doing to protect lands and waters and fish and other species, and really learned how powerfully the community is applying their own laws to protect fish. Especially, I was interested in freshwater fish, but the community has very rich and dynamic fish and marine mammal harvesting, you know, local culture as well. And yeah, Pawlatuck's an amazing place. I have not been there in over a decade. So, you know, I'm just really grateful that I had that experience to learn about how the community is applying Inuvialuit law to protect their community. And that really was instructive for me, because I realized, as someone who's Métis and grew up in Alberta, I had a responsibility to come home and really, really work closely on how do we make sure that, you know, Indigenous laws in Canada, in Alberta, are applied to protecting fish and waters back in Alberta as well. So I'm really indebted to Andy and Millie and other knowledge keepers in the community that I was so lucky to work with, because it absolutely, you know, encouraged me to come home and do that work in my own province.
So it's such a privilege to talk to you about it too, because I'm like a little starstruck.
Oh no, please don't be.
And I was quite inspired by the way your websites don't focus on just one little thing. It's not just research, it's not just your courses that you teach, it's not just your artwork, but it's everything that goes into like your conceptual understanding. And I'm really curious what inspires the fishy portraits that you do on some of your websites.
That's a great question. So 6 years ago, when I was living and working in Ottawa, it was my first year living in Ottawa. My friend Erica Violet Lee, who's this amazing Nehiyo poet and writer and very dear friend, I can't remember why, but I sent her a drawing of a possum. She really liked possums, and I did a really simple digital sketch of a possum, and then I wrote underneath, "Oh, the possibilities." And then someone was like, "Why don't you draw fish? Like, you work on fish, you should draw fish." And so then I drew a northern pike or a jackfish, and like I look back at it, and it's not a very proficient drawing, but it is like the drawing that started this kind of passion for. I grew up, my dad's an artist, like he kind of taught me how to draw. Then I started this series where every Friday I would draw a fish. Mm-hmm. And it was a joke on Fish Friday, which is a Catholic thing. I wasn't raised in the Catholic Church, but my dad was. And so I sort of, and then it grew from there, and people responded really positively to those drawings. And I realized they were a really effective way to kind of celebrate the different fish that I've either like grown up eating. So like I grew up eating whitefish and rainbow trout and pike and walleye and different fish that my late stepdad caught and that we caught as well in rivers and lakes around central Alberta. And yeah, and so I just started, and then a lot of the fish had backstories. Like there's one, I have a lamprey, I call Larry the lamprey, and I've been threatening for almost 7 years now to make a children's book about Larry the lamprey and how he learns how to be a better relative, because they can be an invasive species. So anyways, but there's lots of amazing Indigenous scholars doing work on invasive species. And, you know, that's not my realm, but yeah, for a long time, I've wanted to sort of tell fish stories that way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and that led also, or it tied into, I was already using sturgeon as a way to kind of tell stories about decolonial revenge in Scotland. And I have sort of a character that I write with the Ness Namweo, who's a sort of like decolonial sturgeon who travels from the prairies and teaches the British people about what they did here. So yeah, I think it just sort of grows out of, I come from a family of storytellers and artists, and I think that, yeah, I'm also like deeply inspired by the way they sort of approach some of these questions. And so it felt very natural to just start drawing fish characters and give them stories. And then what really blew me away was people were really receptive to it. And they were like, "Why don't you include that in your talk?" And I was like, "Really?" And they're like, "Yeah." And I was like, and so it all felt a little magical, because I, you know, going through university, you really, I think it's changing a little bit, but I think there's a lot of pressure put on students to sort of make students feel like the only way to be taken seriously is to be very serious. But I really appreciate that a lot of people are breaking that mold.
So sorry to interrupt, but we're going to take a really quick commercial break.
CITR is powered by Guayaquil Yerba Mate. Yerba Mate is a naturally caffeinated drink that comes in a variety of formats, from loose leaf to cans to bottles. Yes, the yellow ones. Guayaquil Mate is all organic, non-GMO, and sure to make you come to life. Guayaquil is more than just a Yerba Mate brand. They're focused on personal, social, ecological, and cultural growth through their commitment to regenerative practices, which include stewarding the South Atlantic rainforest and partnering with indigenous South American communities through the production of Yerba Mate. Visit guayaquil.com, G-U-A-Y-A-K-I.com, to learn more and find this delicious drink near you. Or stop by CITR station on UBC campus for a free Yerba Mate can. Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
Welcome back to 101.9 FM Unseated Airwaves. I'm Cleo, and we are talking to Dr. Zoe Todd. Know that you have been a professor for a bit now. In your years as a student before becoming a professor, are there any like notable experiences or like observations you had as an Indigenous student in academia that you carried forward into your teaching practices?
Yeah, both negative and positive, or positive and negative. I've talked elsewhere about how I did an undergrad in biology, and 20 years ago, biology just really wasn't an open and dynamic space yet. and so I really struggled in that program because I came in really passionate about the environment and about animals and other living beings. And then they just immediately threw you into sort of like, and now we're going to dissect them and we're going to, categorize them. And what I realized now is what was missing was sort of like that understanding of animals and more than human beings as, you know, beings with their own agency and stories. And yeah, and so I didn't do well, and I talk about how I failed classes. But the most incredible thing happened because my mom was a journalist, and she had interviewed this professor, Alan Thompson, who had won a teaching award. And she interviewed him like 2 or 3 days after I started university. And being a proud mom, one of the first things she told him when she went to interview him, she said, "Oh, my daughter just started university." And he, being who he was, he had won, it was called the University Cup at the University of Alberta, and it was for teaching. He said, "You tell your daughter to come visit me." And so I went and saw this professor who I had no idea who he was. And he said that I asked him something no student had ever asked him before when they came to him to like a meeting. And I asked him about himself. I said, like, what got you into medicine? And he said he was kind of so floored how I did that. And he said, why don't you work in my lab? And it's amazing that he did that, because most other professors in that era would not have taken me. I wasn't a top, like, I had an okay average coming out of university, but I wasn't like, I didn't get a scholarship to McGill, you know, like I wasn't the cream of the cream. I was someone who was working 2 jobs and volunteering and, you know, kind of just keeping my head above water. And if he had gone through the normal sort of route, I wouldn't have made it into his lab, but we just kind of had this encounter that way that, you know, I was able to, you know, I was so lucky that my mom had told him that, you know, proudly about me. And for 5 years, I worked for him. Even when I was failing science courses, he said that what was really important to him was that he knew as a Métis student that I was facing barriers, and he sort of really made space for me. And he, you know, encouraged me to contribute to the lab in a way that meant that I was also included as co-author on papers. Mm-hmm. And even when I was failing classes, he was the person who said, you know, you're really passionate about people. Maybe you should minor in a social science. And he sat down with me and sort of said, like, what did you do well in? And I said, oh, I did really well in English and anthropology. And he said, maybe you should do anthropology. You know, let's forget about how you failed biochemistry twice. And let's focus on the positive. And that kind of was that changed the course of my life. Because then when I got into, you know, my minor in anthropology, it turned out I was actually really good at those courses. And it put me on a different trajectory. I could have easily have just failed out of university if I hadn't had that kind of direct one-on-one support. And most students in major universities, you know, don't have that. Like, mm-hmm. you really can easily slip between the cracks. And so, yeah, Dr. Thompson is just, I continuously come back to that kind of commitment he had to me, even when on paper I wasn't doing well. But he could see something, right? And I've tried to really take that to heart, and, you know, secure funding or find ways to support students who are, you know, are big picture thinkers or really, really creative and really inspiring, and find ways to kind of ensure that they can be part of sort of research collectives that I'm in, or, you know, find ways to sort of like support their work and their vision. And that's because Dr. Thompson modeled that for me, and, you know, and we still are in touch, and I'm just incredibly grateful for him. So even though, you know, there were professors who sort of said, I don't know why you're in university, there was always Dr. Thompson who was like, you're smart, you don't fit in this box. And mm-hmm. I think that really showed me, you know, that was in the early 2000s, and that wasn't a time when universities were necessarily, you know, making space for quirky people. So I've just been really lucky that way, because when I've encountered people who sort of said, like, none of what you're doing makes sense, I've always been able to say, that's okay. You know, it doesn't have to make sense to everyone. And mm-hmm. it's because he modeled that for me as a science, like a scientist, mm-hmm. which still blows me away that he kind of took that chance. So, yeah, so that's my sort of just one of my guiding stars.
I'm happy to report that I think you've accomplished your goal of carrying it forward. Before our interview today, I peeked at your Rate My Prof score. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Rate My Prof. For any listeners, it is a website that lets students reflect on instructors and courses and kind of leave like a Yelp review, basically. And you have a 4.8 out of 5. It's just like a really good score. Like, I personally use Rate My Prof when I'm researching courses I want to take and professors I'm unfamiliar with. Like, you have a 100% would take again rating, as well as, like, people have described you as a gem that truly cares about topics and shines most when engaging with students. That you're making a fantastic impact in your classroom spaces.
I mean, it has been the privilege of my life to teach students at Carleton in Ottawa, where I just finished working, and mm-hmm. Just working with some of the most dedicated and brilliant students, and students who are very courageous and not scared to take on, you know, broken colonial systems. Also just really, I got very sick during COVID, with COVID, and that really drove home for me as a teacher, if I was experiencing that, and I have all the sort of security of a job and, you know, stable housing and things like that, it really, you know, it made very clear that it was very important to make sure that I was flexible through the pandemic for students. Mm-hmm. And I made that a really strong priority. And I think that came through in the experience that students were sharing with me of how they experienced those classes that we did online. And yeah, so I'm really grateful to have worked with really, really wonderful students at Carleton.
As a student that was going through university in my undergrad during the pandemic, the most powerful spaces were when the professors really cared about the well-being of their students and really fostered the community, even on Zoom. Because, you know, it's a little like, not very personal talking to someone through a screen, but during Zoom for like at least a year, that was the most social interaction a lot of us got. And being a student, a big part of like being at a university institution is the conversations you get to have with other people that are studying and like-minded and pushing their thinking outside of certain boxes. The conversations are so valuable, and I find that professors that actually exuded care and compassion were the ones that made everyone feel comfortable to have those conversations. Because, you know, it's intimidating to share your thoughts, especially when you're sitting in your bedroom and you're kind of looking at everyone and everyone's like turning off their cameras and hiding in the breakout rooms.
Yeah, I mean, I really credit students through the pandemic for weathering a level of uncertainty that I've never experienced as a student. Like, you know, I lived through 2008 and the, you know, the financial crisis and things like that, but just the level of chaos that hit undergraduate and graduate students in the last almost three years. Like and my colleagues that I really admire who really put that at the forefront. I think there's a shift happening in what teaching looks like too. And it's because students are driving that, and it's really important. And I tell people, like, it's been so exciting to get to teach Gen Z. there's a level of drive and passion to create the world that we should have, and I really feel it. You know, and I'm an elder millennial, I'm an old fart, and we had literally a different worldview 20 years ago of like what we thought we were going to do with our time on the planet. And I really love being in the classroom because students have a vision of the world that is really important. Like, really, you know, my generation created Facebook and Twitter, you know, and like that turned out to be these sort of very complicated things that have caused a lot of harm, but also created a lot of, you know, spaces for diverse ways of kind of expressing, you know, knowledge and stories. And so, I think all the educators that I'm, you know, really proud to work with really take that to heart. And yeah, but I just think that we're in the middle of a massive global upheaval, and we just kind of have to do our best.
We'll roll with the punches and kind of see what we can do with what we have.
Exactly. Like, you know, the only constant is change.
And while you're kind of thinking about that, we're going to hop into our second commercial break.
Hey, why are you so sad today?
My succulent died.
Can you even kill those things?
It's okay. There's a Dead Succulent Haunt episode every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on CITR. To help your plants grow and to help you mourn those you've lost.
Come on, let's go start some cuttings and listen to Dead Succulent Haunt with Everly on CITR 101.9.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
We are back with Unseen Airwaves, broadcasted on 101.9 FM. I'm Cleo, joined by Dr. Todd. I found like a really interesting experience of being like a student online, especially I'm currently in my fourth year of my undergrad and I'm studying sociology with a minor in critical Indigenous studies. And a lot of my work is centered on Denendeh, which is like Treaty 8 and 11 territory in the NWT. Because that's my home territory. That's where my grandmother and my ancestry comes from. That studying and writing and working with Dene methodologies while on Musqueam unceded lands feels a little alienating because I'm sitting here getting all my information from like books, which some of them are really helpful. I have a couple books that are written by Dene elders that were published in like the 90s and 2000s. Fantastic. But it'll never be quite what you need to be in the community. And like having like the regulation of folks that are like living what you're writing. Because, you know, I'm 21, I'm a student. I clearly do not have all the world experience to say, this is how it's done. Because no one has the authority to say this is the definitive answer and way to go about certain things, especially in research. But I find it was really interesting to be able to do some of my coursework while home on Zoom. And it makes me think maybe we don't have to be leaving community to be pursuing higher education. Because that's kind of a traumatic experience for a lot of folks to have to leave their home to go learn, to bring it back home. And then you have to come back home and you talk differently and you act differently because now you've been like institutionalized into the academic bureaucracy that we kind of have to adapt to, which is useful in terms of other concepts and other ongoings between relationships. But going home always feels different and always feels weird. But the idea that one day, hopefully not solely through Zoom, but in other hybrid formats, Indigenous students can do their work from home and from their home communities, where the support is, where the knowledge is, and where the land is. Because I love the mountains, but I do miss the boreal forest and like the Great Slave Lake, and I miss whitefish.
Yeah.
That is okay. I might get hate for that, but like a good rainbow trout or pickerel, yeah. I am so happy.
And, you know, that's such a powerful point. And I think, you know, that's sort of like a really good set of marching orders for those of us who are doing this work in the academy to really pay attention to, because I kind of learned from being in Scotland at the University of Aberdeen, which was founded in like 1495. And the initial goal of that university was to take the firstborn sons of wealthy landowners and turn them into like priests, and so it's very like very particular kind of teaching.
Yeah.
Take these young men away from their families and teach them, you know, Christianity, and then, you know, then they were sort of tasked with carrying out whatever the church needed, and it was a very alienating experience for me to go from Edmonton, where I had lived for 27 years of my entire life, I'd never lived away, and then I went to Aberdeen, Scotland, where I had no family. And it was like a completely different world. And there were things about it that were amazing and like very like expansive and life-changing for me, but also broke me in a lot of ways. And I think that you know, being home, as you said, like being with our family, part of the reason I'm so thankful that I'm able to be here now is that, you know, these are not my homelands. I'm definitely occupying someone else's unceded homelands, but my family is here, and just the difference it's made in the kind of work that I do and just who I am in the world. And so I totally agree. I think that some universities are starting to get it, and they're starting to be more flexible. Mm-hmm. In you know, even students, staff, and teachers being allowed to either spend some other time at home in their community. And I think it's definitely, you've given us some good marching orders to sort of continue to push for that. And I know, you know, I have colleagues who are sort of trying to think about how to do that at a, you know, every scale. And obviously there's amazing, like, I'm not from your territory, but I hear amazing things about Tchinta and, you know, the kind of land-based pedagogy that people are doing in the NWT. And I just think that we're at a really exciting time, you know, because universities are also kind of structurally in some ways falling apart, you know, like 600 years of, well, some of them started in the 1200s, 1100, you know, like, you know, millennium of kind of a certain kind of education that was sort of then planted on all these stolen lands, you know, it doesn't serve our needs as people, like humans, and then community members, and and so I kind of I take a lot of inspiration from folks who are not scared to say, why don't we do it differently? This is obviously not working. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are some universities that are willing to take those risks. Others are going to come very reluctantly into that space, but others are like, yeah, let's just try it. And those are the good ones.
Yeah, I feel like UBC is definitely doing a lot of really good work. Although some of it's a little like give and take, there's a lot of like good spaces for Indigenous community and support while on campus. And like, I know you did some of your education here in Canada, and I'm wondering if there's a big difference between like receiving support for like being an Indigenous person in academia here compared to Scotland.
Oh yeah, big time.
Like a big shift for international schooling, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, just even, I remember just sort of being like, but we're part of the Commonwealth, and you know, the UK was like, we don't care. Like, I was like, but that's how you kept us in your sphere of influence. You promised us we would be like partners. And you realize quickly, like, we're not partners with the UK. They could care less, you know, could not care less about who you are or where you came from. And yeah, and what was really interesting in going to Scotland was realizing how little a lot of white British people know about what Britain did here. Mm-hmm. They don't know. Like, they didn't know that, like, the first prime minister was Scottish. They don't know the history. Like, it's like the Hudson's Bay Company never heard of it. Or if they have, a small number of people had who like literally themselves worked for the Hudson's Bay Company through the 40s, 50s, 60s, right? Because they were still sending, you know, Hudson's Bay men out to communities. So yeah, I think it was a little bit kind of humbling to realize like, oh, Canada is in a lot of ways still kind of to Europeans, like just a colony out there. Like, yes, it's an independent nation now that repatriated its constitution, but in their mind, like, the, you know, Canada's sort of like, oh, isn't she cute? Like, she's got a lot of trees and oil and minerals, but we don't know anything else. And of course, I'm being a little bit unfair. Like, it's a bit more complicated than that. But what was really clear was that white British scholars were not reading Indigenous scholars at all. Like, they were still telling me to cite like really outdated anthropological texts. And I appreciate that I read through like Vilhelmer Stephenson and Knud Rasmussen, and I learned the history of who they were and what they did so that I could kind of piece that together with the impacts that their kind of approaches had. And those are complicated people too. Like, they're celebrated in parts of the North. So I'm not here to, you know, by certain, you know, people who are related to them, right? You know, so it's always way more nuanced I always try to remind myself to be a bit more nuanced, you know, but they weren't reading Vine Deloria. They weren't reading Audra Simpson. They weren't reading Glenn Coulthard. Like, they weren't reading these really important critical thinkers from Indigenous nations across Canada and the US and South America. You know, they were still really relying on anthropologists and other white, predominantly white scholars who went into communities and studied. And even the way that my program tried to pressure me to do my PhD work is, I will absolutely never, ever, ever pressure students to sort of develop their projects the way that they were trying to make me do that work. Like, they still had it in their mind that good anthropology was sending someone into a space to do sort of that weird heroic, like, you know, explorer kind of work. And you know, the work that we do in our projects today, it's very community driven. The community tells us what their priorities are, where they need funding. And like, that was just not happening in the British academic environment. Like, it, and still, like, even a decade on from my time there, like, I don't think they get it yet. Like, and the part of the reason is they're in a whole other continent. So they're so removed from the conversations we're having here. And it just really felt like they were always kind of like looking over the edge of the fence with a telescope. And like, I hear things in the colonies are good this winter. You know, and it's just it was a really weird experience. And, you know, I'm glad I got to go experience it, because, you know, what a strange thing to get to do in a lifetime. But I was so grateful to come home when I was done. And I say really that my 7 years teaching at Carleton were like my second PhD, because that's when I was immersed in a community of Indigenous scholars and colleagues. And I really made a commitment to read everything I could get my hands on from critical Indigenous studies, and kind of really be able to place the things I saw and experienced in the UK within the context of, you know, brilliant Indigenous folks here, and, you know, and other displaced, dispossessed and diasporic peoples who are writing against empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shifting gears a bit, I am really curious about your ideas around your public materials for an INDG course 2015 and SOCI 28010, which is Indigenous Ecological Ways of Knowing. I found on your website, and you have all your slides posted, you have all your articles and things linked or posted in your website, and I'm really curious what your idea is to have an open course like that while also teaching it in an institution.
Yeah, so I kind of found out by accident that at Carleton, faculty own our courses. I didn't know this. Not every university does this, but you own your course material. It's your copyright.
Oh.
And people were asking, like I was sharing, you know, I was tweeting like, today we're learning this. And people were sort of saying, oh, I wish I was in your class. I was saying like, no, sorry, it's closed. And so I sat down one day and I said, you know, I could share aspects of the course with the public if they wanted to follow along on their own. Mm-hmm. Like I wouldn't be instructing them. They wouldn't have access to like the in-class discussions or the lectures. I wasn't sharing that part of it. That was for the students. But I felt that it kind of could remove some of the barriers between the university, because universities really pride themselves right now on having Indigenous content, but a lot of Indigenous and other sort of like historically excluded communities can't access the university like other, like physically, or like it's just not a welcoming space in, mm-hmm. in some, you know, some universities are doing a way better job and are becoming like gathering spaces, and it's really inspiring. But, and so I just thought in the fall of, I think it was in the fall of 2020, I did a little experiment. What was it, 2021? I can't remember now, it's all a blur, but I said, I'll put up my syllabus, I'll put up the links to whichever of the articles are publicly available, not all of them are, mm-hmm. and I'll put up slides. And there was a really positive response, like people were really excited and more than I could have imagined. And so, and you know, like these artists in Omaha, Nebraska took one of the teaching exercises from one of my slides. I do this like watershed exercise. And they turned that into an exhibit. Like they did an art show that encouraged wow. people in Omaha to come to this installation they did that situated people within the watersheds around them, and mm-hmm. And other things like that. And so, and then later, like it became also really clear that in sharing those materials, I was also making it possible for more precarious teachers, so people who weren't on permanent contracts like me, to take some of that material and remix it and use it. And so also like it felt like it was serving a bit of a labor solidarity purpose as well, because it was it was enabling people to have the resources to do things that maybe they weren't being supported to do as fully as they deserve to be. Mm-hmm. So in a little bit of an experiment, it's not like as grand as I initially envisioned. Like in the fall of 2020, I was like, maybe I will put the video, like I'll make my own separate videos just for the public that are not the ones for the course. But I just, then I realized I was really burnt out from the pandemic, and people were still happy with what I had shared. So, mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, I know that Kim Talbear and is offering some of her courses now are going to be public. And I just think it's a really, it's just a cool way. And of course, there's all sorts of like the large MOOCs across, I can't remember what that stands for, but the mass online courses, mm-hmm. Like the U of A Faculty of Native Studies has a really, really good one that on, you know, sort of like Indigenous Studies 101 that's available. And, you know, those are really exciting. I think anything we can do to kind of tear down some of the barriers to universities can kind of help with some of those structural challenges. But I also know like they remain very colonial spaces. Like yeah. I know that this one little course doesn't do a whole lot, but it was kind of nice just how people were following along and then sharing their experiences of that. That was a really cool experience. Yeah.
I love how it utilizes things like Twitter and Twitter hashtags. So the conversation is expanded. Even if you don't have like the classroom setting for discussions, you have Twitter feed and you have people around you that might also do the same readings you're doing and follow along with your course. And I think that's like so valuable to have outside of an institution, especially like I recently did a Decenta course in the spring of this year in May, and I did a Moose High Tanning course, and we focused a lot on Dene research methodologies and ethics. I have never really had an experience like Decenta where I was validated in just being present and that being enough, but also having like all the knowledge that you carry forward with you from like personal experience, family heritage, observations of the world and position. And that was so valued in those spaces. Or sometimes being a young Gen Z going through university, sometimes like, oh, but you don't really know anything yet. You're too young to know anything yet. And in my cohort of my Decenta course, I was one of the youngest folks there. There's probably a handful of us that are in university, like 3 or 4 of us. The rest of them are mostly in like their late 20s to like late 30s. A lot of them were mothers and their children came to the camp. A lot of them had like extended family that were coming to visit them while they were at camp, because I believe the furthest person came from Thunder Bay, Ontario. One person came from Vancouver, and then a couple of people came from Iqaluit up in Nunavut. And it was just like a lot of really positive experience of like, we carry knowledge and it doesn't have to be validated or recognized by an institution, especially when a couple of us coming through from our undergrads being like, yeah, I feel very invalidated sometimes in classrooms, or even feel tokenized when someone looks at you and says, okay, what's the Indigenous perspective? I can't speak for all Indigenous people. I can barely speak for all Dene people. Like, I can speak for myself and my perspective. But in some spaces, people forget that pan-Indigeneity can be really harmful and very flattening of all experiences. And that's not what we want to do.
it's really my time in Ottawa really showed me like the government and certain colonial institutions really want a pan-Indigenous approach, because then they don't have to deal with Indigenous peoples as like sovereign societies and nations and they don't have to learn different protocols and laws and stories. They can just sort of, you know, like, ah, oh, we've dealt with this. We did some diversity. We're good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think I think what you your experience you just described is exactly like that affirmation that Indigenous folks, everybody, it's weird to me, like studying anthropology, it was really weird to me. That people could build entire careers around sort of like becoming an expert on Métis. But if I talked about my family, people are like, oh, you're being biased. No, I'm not. I think what's really exciting about just all the really vibrant Indigenous scholarship happening across the country is especially critical Indigenous studies that's really focused on sovereignty and really engaging relationships to place and tending to those relationships. Is just that real affirmation that, yeah, you already know so much. You know more than the professor, probably have a lot of classes. And so, yeah, and that kind of, I like that kind of disruption of the power hierarchy. And it's just this silly thing that was imported from Europe by, seeing the little houses that those young men lived in, those medieval, like, I really started to understand, like, this wasn't, like, it's a whole structure that they imposed on us, and we just weirdly adopted it here, and we're like, okay, I guess that's all a university can be, it has to look like Cambridge, or it has to look, and, like, I was at Yale, and I remember someone pointed out, they're like, yeah, this was built, in like the early 1900s, but they went and they put acid on the sandstone to make it look older, so it would look more like the UK. Like, that just blows my mind, because they're in these beautiful like stolen lands next to Long Island, and they could have, you could build something that like really tends to that place and whose lands those are, and and deals with like the rich and dynamic and very, even painful histories of the sort of enslavement of African peoples in that part of the U.S. as well. Like, there's so much you could do differently. So that's what's, you know, something that's really exciting to be in Vancouver. It's really a place where First Nations in these unceded territories are really pushing, you know, universities to do better, and it's setting an example for the whole country. So yeah.
I totally agree. Even if you walk around like UBC campus, the amount of like Indigenous architecture you see, although some of it is in like weird positions and like the context and history of some of them might be a little strange, the fact that they're here and they're being celebrated, acknowledged, and improved upon by each generation of Indigenous people that come to UBC, plus their allies that are like trying their best to create the spaces to, whether or not you want to say decolonize or indigenize, but like to claim these spaces as ours and make them ours, especially like thinking of like futurisms and thinking, who are the next batch of Indigenous students coming through here? What will they see, and how do I ensure what they see reflects how they should feel in this space? Because although it's not made for us, we can remake it into a space that like that holds us gently and uplifts us to do what we need to do. And a lot of that time is like, you know, going to class and taking just what you need from it and leaving a good portion of like some of the citations behind. Because although it's interesting, I don't really need to reread what's been written over and over again by white people.
Yeah.
I would rather take some of the core ideas and focus it on like people that I'm a lot more trusting of their word. For example, like Glenn Kohlhart or like Leanne Simpson and other like contemporary Indigenous critical thinkers, both of who were actually at DeCento when I was there.
Yeah.
Talk about leveling the playing field of hierarchy between professor and student. Sitting with Leanne Simpson and Glenn Kohlhart at like 8 a.m. drinking coffee before tanning hides for 6 hours was very humbling, but also like kind of stacked the idea of like educational hierarchy for me. Because I'd spent 3 years in university. The professor is the head of the room. They have all authority. If you need an extension and they say no, you don't get an extension. You got to suck it up and push through whatever's going on.
Yeah.
But then in a space where it's like we're having breakfast together, we're talking, chatting about life. And it always kind of leads back to conversations of research and conversations of how to conceptualize it in a way that makes it feel good and sit good for us. Because there are moments where you do research and your professor tells you, you should do it this way, you should be more, I don't know, like less attached and personal in your research. But how do you do that when you're literally talking about your family? And how do you accommodate that and remain accountable to the people you're talking for, about, and with? Because it's not just one or the other, it's all of them at once.
It's really true. And as you're describing that beautiful experience, I'm really thinking about my very, you know, good friend and colleague, Geraldine King, who's a prof at McGill. And she ran this amazing land-based course in Kitigan-Zibi this summer with members of Kitigan-Zibi First Nation. And yeah, just like the driving principle of her approach to teaching is really that disrupting of the hierarchy of professor and student, and that kind of humility that I'm so excited to see, because the Western Academy is all about hierarchy.
Oh yes.
Really, hierarchies, you know, like I was published one more time than this person. So, you know, it's really easy to kind of fall into that trap, because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of rewards put in place for that. But you know, I just remember, you know, my dad didn't go to grad school. He finished high school, and he upgraded when I was little, and then did an undergrad while I was a little girl. And he would take us to campus, and we would run around the fine arts studios because he was doing his BFA at the University of Alberta. And you know, I think in a lot of ways he demystified what could have been a really alienating space for me, because when I came to the university, you know, 15 years later, I was like, oh, I know this place. That's where my dad would get coffee and go have a cigarette. So it was way less intimidating. And so I think, you know, your wonderful experiences at DeCento, the kind of work that, you know, colleagues like Geraldine are doing, like, it's, those are the kind of really important guiding stars to how to shift these relationships. And you know, and there's examples all over the U.S. too of sort of like really critical sort of like Black geographies and Black feminist scholarship that kind of does similar things as well, that are upending a lot of these kind of academic hierarchies as well, and are super inspiring. There's lots of just like really cool scholarship, and that kind of scholarship that's really grounded in change. And obviously, like, I'm not an expert on sort of South and Central America, but there's a long tradition in both places of like sort of activism within the university being, you know, very concretely tied to changing structures. And so, yeah, I think we have so many inspiring examples to look to do things. And it feels like this is the moment, like, it, even though a lot of things are falling apart, like, there's just I feel a very hopeful kind of energy, really, in a way I haven't felt in a while. Like, I just feel very hopeful.
Yeah. Even in the 4 years I've been in academia, I've been seeing the difference. And like, when things fall apart, it means you can put them back together in different ways. And you can rework them in ways that didn't make sense before. And you can correct any mistakes that might have led things to falling apart the way they are. Because a lot of it's systemic. A lot of it was kind of set up to fail almost. If you look at it long term, you're like, how is this sustainable? It's not. Before we wrap up, because I know we've been on the call for a hot second, I have one last kind of conceptual idea I want to run by you. So in thinking back with your 2014 paper on fish pluralities, there was one case study about the active site of engagement facilitated by schools between teachers and local families, specifically new coming teachers that are from like Southern or other spaces that are coming into a new space, especially one that has very specific relationships to land, to subsistence, and to like community. But I was kind of thinking about that and the way that the high school would pair up these newcomers with a family to introduce them to a contextual space to enter into relationship with the land they are now on. Also with the more bureaucratic format of hunting licenses and tags and things. I thought it was so incredibly interesting that it was good for both sides. Not only for, like, you know, the locals to see, oh, these people do want to learn and they want to be respectful and they want to know how to do so in this context, but also the people coming in being like, I'm not just an outsider, I'm also part of this community. And when I was thinking about that, I think about wider Canadian, North American, Turtle Island, what have you, and the relationship between non-Indigenous and Indigenous people. Because we don't see the eye to eye very often. But I'm thinking of like a futurism in which that's a dynamic that is prominent everywhere, in which those relationships are fostered, whether or not they're like formally set up between schools or whatnot, but that it's not a huge disconnect between Indigenous practices as being that's only for Indigenous people, but it's for anyone that finds themselves on this Indigenous land. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, so I've been reading Vine Deloria lately, because unfortunately he wasn't taught in my PhD in Scotland or my biology degree. But I've been so lucky to get to spend more time with his work right now. And in God is Red, he really makes the point that like Indigenous cosmologies, or, you know, if we use the word religion, or he's thinking about religion in that book, but like Indigenous worlds are really intimately tied to place. And he says, you know, like the thing with Christianity is that it's disconnected from place. Like they took it from the place it came from, you know, in a very specific part of the world, and then they tried to recreate it everywhere. And that has created all sorts of problems because it got weaponized as a tool of oppression. And and I really like just taking that moment to think about how each place is so special. And I don't know, there's sort of like something I'm trying to work through there, that there's so many displaced and dispossessed communities across the globe right now because of what white supremacy, imperialism, capitalism, and extraction and other violent forces have done to remove people from their homelands so that a small number of people could make money and accrue wealth. But that kind of, that turning towards really taking the time in the ways that we can respectfully learn about a place and what it takes to be a good visitor or, you know, presence in that place, for me was really modeled by the way that friends like Andy and Millie Impala Talk, you know, take the time to take new teachers out on the land and just make sure they know where they're so lucky to get to work. And they, you know, and that time that friends took to take me out on the land in Impala Talk, you know, just this random Métis person who was interested in fish and really showing me the amount of care that goes into protecting those lands. And in the city, it can be a little bit harder because there's just so many non-Indigenous people, you know, overwhelming just places just due to the way that, you know, colonization has shaped urban spaces. But I really think there's something in there in, you know, Vine's thinking around place that maybe can help us untangle some of those like painful things that people are dealing with right now. Because the question really maybe becomes, how do we enact care wherever we find ourselves? And what does that look like? And how do we strip white supremacy? And like Aileen Martin Robinson talks about, you know, the white possessive. Like, if I think that it can only be accomplished if we really get it out of settler colonizers' heads that they have any kind of ownership over places that they've stolen. Mm-hmm. And that really, I mean, we're all just visitors to the planet for a brief period of time before we go wherever we end up going after. I don't know if any of that is very coherent, but just for me, I'm really thinking about like wherever I find myself, I'm very fortunate to be there. And I, in the last decade, have not lived in my homelands. So, mm-hmm. you know, for me to be here with care. And so really listening to local nations and what they have to say about what it takes to be a good visitor. Yeah.
I think that was wonderfully answered. And I think you definitely added to my thoughts. Thank you. before we end up our call, is there any last thoughts you want to share with listeners?
Oh no, I'm just really grateful, Cleo, like for taking the time to like just getting to learn a bit more about you is really lovely. And yeah, just thanks for listening. We're starting up our Institute for Freshwater Fish Futures at Simon Fraser University, and we're hoping to have kind of events in the coming years mm-hmm. and that will be focused on, you know, how to be good relatives to freshwater fish. But we're not only focused on freshwater fish, we're open to all fish and aquatic species. And so we know there's lots of good folks here who are passionate about fish, and we look forward to connecting with you over time. So thank you.
Ils ont chinchon.